Now the voices of the men and women whose words and deeds made the news. This week's Voices and Events.
Now, a new departure in radio journalism. Voices and Events. The program that brings the important happenings of the past 7 days in the voices of the people who made the news. These sounds of history come to you through new techniques of reporting and recording, pioneered by the NBC News and Special Events Department. Now the editor of Voices and Events, James Fleming.
Let's consider Yale, Broadway, and Thanksgiving one at a time. There was at least one evidence of security in the news this week. A man in a profession notorious for insecurity was given a handsome new 10-year contract. Yes, Coach Herman Hickman of Yale, all 300 pounds of him, was about the most secure individual in these parts. He's not only a shrewd man on the bench, he's one of the best latter-day storytellers. There was, for instance, the day that Herman Hickman first came to New Haven.
You know, I'll never forget the first time I walked into my office up there at Yale. Why, I said to myself, well, country boy, it's a long ways from the hills of Tennessee to Yale. And I wish Grandpa could see me right now. You know, my grandpa was a diehard Confederate veteran, and I'll never forget what he said to me when I told him that I'd decided to come up north to coach football at West Point. He looked at me and said, son, I want you to learn everything that they know about war, and then come on back home, for this thing ain't over with yet.
Robert E. Sherwood's a hard man to classify. You can call him a biographer, a businessman, perhaps politician. Well, this week, Mr. Sherwood turned up in his role of playwright and champion of the theater. He became chairman of the Council for the Living Theater, and he told Voices and Events what he was up to.
In this country, we have National Apple Week, National Necktie Week, Mother's and Father's Day. But there has never been a concerted effort on the part of the theater to stimulate the public with the all-important fact that without a living theater in this country, we cannot pretend to have a national culture. All over this country, there are people who love the theater and who keep it alive with amateur groups. But the vast majority of these people will never get a chance to see South Pacific. There are now two companies playing South Pacific, one in New York and one in Chicago. There ought to be six companies playing it all over the country. What we hope is that the living theater can be brought back to the people and vice versa. Thank you.
Well, this week is going to be a busy one for actors anyhow, with a Thanksgiving matinee in addition to their usual performances. Before the day of cranberry sauce and pumpkin pie moves in on us, let's prepare ourselves with a bit of history about Thanksgiving. In our time, you'll recall, it was the most controversial of holidays.
Hear ye the proclamation of the President of the United States.
Until the fateful year of 1939, this country had struggled along with a single Thanksgiving Day. Then, with the approval of many merchants, President Roosevelt proclaimed this holiday 1 week earlier. Some states observed the new date, others the old one, and three states hit the jackpot by observing both. As Ben Grauer observed back in 39, even the turkeys were going mad.
Two turkeys committed suicide at dawn today rather than go through with this double Thanksgiving ordeal. Freed from their crates when a truck top hit an overpass at Jersey City, 25 plump turkeys romped crazily about, pursued by four policemen. Two dashed into the path of a passing automobile, dying ignominiously in the Jersey City gutter. The other turkeys were captured and are ready.
President Roosevelt, who thus tangled with the calendar, particularly enjoyed his own Thanksgiving when he spent it with patients at Warm Springs, Georgia. On those occasions, FDR carved the turkey and made a little speech. This is 1938, and the president read a greeting sent him by Eddie Cantor.
May you and yours have a happy Thanksgiving. I am thankful that I can live in a country where our leaders sit down on Thanksgiving Day to carve up a turkey instead of a map.
now, ladies.
Now we'll have the blessing said, and after that, we'll go to it.
The most famous Thanksgiving proclamations of our time were composed by the late Wilbur L. Cross, for many years governor of Connecticut. His prose captured the true spirit of the season, gave meaning to the day. You will find many of them reprinted in anthologies. And now, through the cooperation of station WTIC in Hartford, we are to hear Governor Cross himself as he proclaimed Thanksgiving in true New England style.
As the colors of autumn stream down the wind, scarlet in sumac and maple, spun gold in the birches, a splendor of smoldering fire in the oaks along the hill, and the last leaves flutter away, and dusk falls briefly about the worker bringing in from the field a late load of fruit, and Arcturus is lost to sight, and Orion swings upward that great sun upon his shoulder, we are stirred once more to ponder the infinite goodness that is set apart for us in all this moving mystery of creation, a time of living and a home. In such a spirit, I appoint Thursday, the 24th of November, a day of public thanksgiving, given under my hand and seal of the state at the Capitol in Hartford, this 10th day of November, in the year of our Lord, 1938, and of the independence of the United States, the 163rd.
We gather together to ask the Lord's blessing. He shapes and vanishes and his will to make known. The wicked oppressing, sees them from distressing. Sing praises to his name, he forgets not his own.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history this week in the voices of the people who made the news. All over the world, NBC correspondents have been on the scene reporting and recording events as they happen to make possible this first-hand report of the never-ending story that is the news. Now again, here is the editor of Voices and Events, James Fleming.
This is the sober fact, stated by our top military man, General Omar Bradley, on Friday. The sober fact at the heart of the news in this winter of discontent.
It is a bruising and shocking fact that when we Americans were committed in Korea, we were left without an adequate margin of military strength with which to face an enemy at any other specific point. Certainly, we were left without the strength to meet a general attack. In the military sense, the free world was left without adequate reserves except for the atomic bomb.
One reason this week that President Truman assured the Chinese that we had no hostile intentions toward them. Our policy was one of forbearance, forbearance with honor. And said Secretary Acheson,
we have no special interests that we want to achieve. We don't want to dominate anyone. We don't want territory. We don't want any of the things for which empires have in the past fought. We want only a world in which we can be free and in which everyone else can be free.
But if Beijing continued its aggression in Korea, our forbearance would give way. In Washington, it's clear that we're on the eve of a great debate on foreign policy, a debate growing out of the election, and the two men who have the platform are the Secretary of State and the Senator from Ohio. It all began early in the week when Senator Taft held a press conference. There were many questions. For example, would the senator run for president in 52?
I'm certainly not a candidate for the nomination. I'm not going to run for president. I don't say that I wouldn't take the nomination if it were offered to me, but I shall make no campaign to get it.
How about isolationism? Are we in for a resurgence of that point of view?
How can we be an isolationist when we're involved in wars and treaties and every kind of international relationship? Can't be more than a question of degree, and certainly not one of principle.
Now, Senator, about this short session of Congress, what should it do?
Adjourn. Well, I don't mean to say there won't be some business, but I don't see that the as I say, a lame duck Congress, except on some matter of great immediate emergency. I doubt if there can be very much done.
Next question, what about armed aid to Europe?
I'm in favor of aid to the Western European countries to help them conduct their defense. I have no hesitation about that. But I do think the whole problem ought to be much more carefully and publicly studied than it has been. Also, this Gray report, which seems to contemplate another $3, 4, 5 billion for economic aid on top of the military. I think that ought to be certainly thoroughly examined in the light of the effect on our own economy.
That was the opinion that stirred the administration to take up the argument. Without mentioning Senator Taft by name, Secretary of State Acheson attacked his point of view with energy at week's end.
Now, I read in the papers, and I'm sure you do too, that there is a species of Homo sapiens which has now become extinct. And very recently, only in the last few weeks, has it become extinct. And that is the isolationist. We're told there aren't any more isolationists. And we're told it's very rude to refer to anybody as an isolationist. And it hurts the feelings of people to use that phrase. And that all isolationists are extinct. They're just as dead as the dodo or the saber-toothed tiger.
And said Secretary Acheson.
And this new species I call the re-examinist. Because the re-examinist says, I want to re-examine all our policies and all our programs. Now, it's possible that a re-examinist might be a farmer that goes out every morning and pulls up all his crops to see how they've done during the night. It might be that that's what it means. Or it might be that this kind of a re-examinist is someone who comes down to breakfast in the morning and looks at his husband and wife and said, do I really love that man or woman? How in the world did I ever turn up here with him or her?
It was very clear that Acheson, supported by the White House, was going to defend his foreign policy with great vigor. It was equally clear that the debate that began this weekend would continue long and loud. Now let's consider a nonpartisan approach to international relations. A number of American farm youngsters have just returned from a year in Europe. They've been learning about the rest of the world in the best possible way by seeing it for themselves. Claire Van Gillister of Montana, for example, went to Switzerland, found out about farming there.
The farmers generally gets up about 5 or 5:30 in the morning and is off to the barn to milk cows. Then off he goes to the field and then to breakfast. But you know, he doesn't sit around after breakfast for a half hour. Off he goes into the field again and comes in for supper about 8 or 8:30 in the evening. It's a long day.
No, it wasn't exactly farming American style. Richard Taylor of Ohio went to Greece. He saw a mighty strange method of thrashing.
I thought one of the interesting methods was their method of thrashing. They would bring their wheat in on the backs of donkeys and spread it out on a flat area, and then take a stone roller with a team of oxen and draw over this grain to separate the seed from the chaff. It will then be thrown into the air, and the wind will separate the chaff.
Maurice Kaur from the tall corn state of Iowa found that farming in Austria had its diverting moments.
Well, in Austria, the same as in America, the farmer is a hard-working man. His average day starts about 5 a.m., when the farmer rises, and of course, he has to do his milking and chores as we do in America. The breakfast was at 6:30 on the last farm I was on and consisted of black coffee and milk and a slice of black bread. This kept us in the field until 9:30 when we had a Jause, which called it in German, or a lunch to us, which consisted of another slice of black bread, a small piece of fatty pork, which is the only meat we had during the day, and a glass of Most, which is hard apple cider, and which they drink a lot of. The water in Austria isn't too good for drinking, and on this last farm I spent 3 weeks on, we drank no water while I was there. It was all Most.
Yes, hard cider turns up in Europe, too. When peoples get to know one another, it not only brings understanding, but removes the fears that grow out of lack of information. One could admit there was plenty to be fearful about in the world this week. Some fears could be tagged and identified. Others were mighty vague. This nation, without warning, found itself at the mercy of the thing. This fabulous monster had taken over most channels of communication. There was, let it be said, no escape from the Thing.
While I was walking down the beach one bright and sunny day, I saw a great big wooden box a-floating in the bay. I pulled it in and opened it up, and much to my surprise, ooh, I discovered a... Right before my eyes, ooh, I discovered a... Right before my eyes, I picked it up and ran to town as happy as a king. I took it to a guy I knew who'd buy most anything. But this is what he hollered at me as I walked in his shop. Ooh, get out of here with that before I call a cop. Ooh, get out of here with that before I call a cop.
Yes, that's the Thing as Tin Pan Alley sees it. Well, in the real world, one could say quite seriously that the Thing was probably communism. No leader of the West would or possibly could predict what the Reds would do next. But many leaders, among them the Prime Minister of Great Britain, probed the nature of communism in search of a clue to peace.
Communist activities are generally camouflaged. In this country, they can generally get a few respectable but misguided people to provide the sheep's clothing. But you know, a denial by a communist doesn't carry very much weight. The obvious fact is that the whole thing is bogus, and no one ought to be so simple as to be deceived. All this elaborate make-believe is an attempt to trick decent, honest people. It's an appeal by the wolves to get the sheep to demonstrate against the use of shepherds and sheepdogs.
Prime Minister Attlee was discussing with the press the Reds' attempt to hold that so-called peace conference in Britain. The facts of the news were grim enough. Their interpretation demanded public attention to thoughtful men as they discussed the dangers of these times.
Stalinism is, for instance, undoubtedly a good method for producing an army and the necessary modern equipment. More particularly in a backward country, it may also be quite a good method for accomplishing vast public works, at whatever cost in human sacrifice. This kind of dictatorship can also, of course, improve the condition of certain sections of the population, that is to say, in practice, the new privileged classes, to quite a large extent, and can thereby, obviously, hope to secure the loyalty of at least some intelligent people who may be disillusioned about communism, but at any rate know on which side their bread is buttered. The general apparatus, indeed, of Stalinism is clumsy and brutal, but to some extent it works, at any rate in Russia. What is essentially wrong with it is that it is inhuman and consequently morally wrong. And it is for that reason, and for that reason only, that if there is any virtue in our own democratic faith, Stalinism is bound, in the long run, to founder.
The familiar voice of Sir Gladwin Jebb, as he recently gave a diplomat's diagnosis of the nature of Stalinism. And alongside the statements of officials, there are many private prophets with definite ideas about it. Now, Kenneth de Courcy is the publisher of a British newsletter. His most publicized feat, the prediction of Russia's possession of the atomic bomb. In Washington this week, he told newsmen,
I have very good reason for believing that Mao Zedong is the second man in the Soviet Empire in the estimation of Stalin. I have heard from very authoritative quarters that Stalin regards Mao Zedong as his second man. We are constantly talking about other personalities in the Politburo and in Russia as the second man or the third man or whatever it may be. But I think that the real fact of the matter is that the man next to Stalin in the whole Soviet Empire is Mao Zedong. And I think we shall see that he is going to fulfill a very, very vital role in Soviet strategy.
Is Mao Zedong second in command, true or false? False, according to Nationalist China's UN delegate, Dr. Chiang. On Thursday, he gave his opinion that Mao Zedong was just a social climber in the hierarchy of communism.
The difficulty in the whole problem is that Mao Zedong in Kuiping fancies that he has been made junior partner in the imperial firm of Stalin and Mao. Mr. President, if we wish to understand the real meaning of Japan's intervention in Korea, we can only find it in Moscow's pattern of world conquest.
Members of Red China's special delegation are scheduled to arrive in New York next Friday, but they want to talk about Formosa, not about Korea. And for another really complex matter, consider Britain's recognition of a government now actively attacking its own troops. Roving Ambassador Sir Esler Denning was visiting Tokyo. The reporter asked, weren't these developments introducing something of a snag in relations between the United Kingdom and Beijing?
I don't know. What is happening is precisely nothing. Whether you call that a snag or not, I wouldn't know.
And the war went on. More of those big B-29 raids on the border cities. In Japan, General Emmett Rosie O'Donnell told Voices and Events about his big problem.
You all realize fully the danger and the implication to bombing a town like this just 2,000 feet away from neutral territory. Hantung is, 2,500 feet across the river. Bombing from the altitude we did with this number of bombs, but we felt perfectly confident that we could do the job without violating Manchurian territory, and everyone was warned very carefully to do so.
The big story from Korea was the weather.
This morning's report indicated that heavy snowfall has started in the area and was considerable hindrance to aerial operations. So it looks like the winter is getting well underway. Well,
that was a Pentagon briefing officer. The bitter cold was the real enemy this week in Korea. Frontline correspondents brought distressing news that there had been a delay in the delivery of some heavy clothing to fighting men. Enough had been sent, said the Pentagon. All will soon be delivered, echoed Tokyo. And the Pentagon got a woman as a Deputy Secretary of Defense. Mrs. Anna Rosenberg was sworn in this week to handle manpower problems. She told Secretary Marshall she'd do her best.
I hope, General, with the work I'm going to do, I can merit your confidence. And all I ask is that everybody inside and outside of the government and the armed services please help me to do a good job.
Well, there are no doubts whatever in my mind. Thank you very much.
No prophet was as yet sure about how much we'd spend for defense in the coming year. But everyone agreed it would be a breathtaking sum. There would be new taxes, no question about that.
We've given a great deal of study to the problems confronted in devising taxes for dealing with profits arising from the defense program. Today I'm giving the committee only the major considerations which have developed from our studies. There is much more detailed information to be made available to the committee as it continues its work. The President has stated that the new tax should be designed to produce $4 billion in additional revenue. I believe our expenditures for military security require the additional taxation at this time.
That was Secretary of the Treasury Snyder as he urged the House Ways and Means Committee to approve a 75% excess profits tax, a highly controversial matter in business circles. We expect to pay the taxes, said most businessmen, but we don't like that old excess profits formula. Find something new. And out in San Francisco, the California Commission on Organized Crime had a lot to say about taxes. The revenue collectors, they suggested, weren't as vigilant as they might be in taking in the money from a rather suspect element of the population.
The income tax returns filed by hoodlums and gangsters with the Federal Bureau of Internal Revenue and with the State Franchise Tax Commission are clothed in statutory secrecy like those filed by all other taxpayers. Nevertheless, without reference to their tax returns, the fabulous personal extravagances year after year of these people and the apparently inexhaustible supply of ready cash, which is so common as to be characteristic, demonstrate that professional criminals as a group do not pay their just and lawful taxes.
That was the committee's lawyer, Warren Olney, speaking in San Francisco. But the crime headlines in California moved to Los Angeles on Friday. The Kefauver Committee came to town, and they called gambler Mickey Cohen to drop by and tell his story.
This is John Storm at the U.S. Senate Crime Inquiry in the Federal Building, Los Angeles. Here's what happened as Mickey Cohen, Los Angeles mobster, faced Senator Kefauver's crime committee today.
Mr. Cohen, he asked you a question, and you answer it the best you can.
We won't.
Well, he's answering my questions.
Well, no, he's not answering your questions. He's asking you whether you know certain things or not. If you know them, tell us about it. If you don't,
he took a police report that was made out from a police department.
That's all right. What he
said. That is trying to make me look as dirty as they possibly can. They arrested me maybe 50, 60 times, and on this report, they have arrested.
Well,
they can arrest you for anything they want on a report. They put an arrest on a report with me and Joe Seeker.
Hold that just a minute. In the Senate Committee on Interstate Commerce, we had another gentleman of the same profession come before us, and his name was Frank Costello. Did you ever see him?
No, sir.
Well, let me tell you what he said. We began to question him.
Sure.
And in all pomposity, 100% degree, he beat his breast, and he said, me, I'm front page stuff. Every time I speak, the paper's got on the front page. That's called egoism.
It's no egoism. That happens to be my case.
Yeah, well, you and Frank Costello have the same point of view, then.
I just spitting on a sidewalk and it'll be in a headline.
I think you mentioned buying an automobile. This year, was it?
That's right.
Having it made specially?
That's right.
What did that cost you?
It's, I think around $16,000.
$16,000?
Mm-hmm.
When did you get that made?
It's been under construction in the last 6-7 months.
Is it finished?
No, not all finished yet.
Is it another automobile?
When I say it's cost me $16,000, I haven't paid it for all of it yet.
But it's still being finished up for you.
That's right. There's some other people that's got investments in it.
Who?
Coach Craft people.
Well.
Well, there's them people. There's
what people. What is the automobile for? Is it for special use?
It's for my protection.
You have been listening to a new departure in radio journalism. Voices and events. This week's Living History. The voices of the people who made the news, recorded as they made it. The sounds of history. James Fleming is the editor and narrator of Voices and Events. This is Bob Warren inviting you to listen next week at this new Sunday hour when the NBC News and Special Events Department brings you the never-ending story that is the news on Voices and Events. This program came to you from the NBC Newsroom in New York.